And the flag?
Johnny Vellacott, reel two.
Oh, I see.
Sorry, carry on.
The flak coming up from the centre or the floor of the valley was white. Well, it rather amused us at first, and some comedian, myself, said, do you think they're trying to improve on our navigation? Anyhow, when we got over Tepelini, the flak there was pretty severe, and it got very severe, but happily we picked up a hole or two, but nobody was shot down. But it was so intense that it was said that why don't we get out and walk on the flak and then we get out of these blooming aircraft? But that was not entertained at all. Anyhow, when we went about and turned to go back to our own base, these fighters had since been refueled and rearmed, and we ran the gauntlet down the valley once again, being met by these fighters. And, oh dear, we picked up a few holes or two. And I remember we came back from one raid, on Bologna, actually, and as we got off and got out of the aircraft at our base, the corporal airframe fitter came up to me and he said, where have you been? Most accusingly. I said, Bologna, you know very well. He said, well, you haven't been doing your job. I said, I beg your pardon. Then he did a little grin. He said, I'm sorry, but look at all these blooming holes. You shouldn't let them do that, you know. Now, my boys will be up all night filling those holes in. So I said, I'm awfully sorry, Lofty, but it's nothing to do with me. It wasn't my fault. And we had a little bit of a chuckle, but the poor old aircraft, well, it did have a fair quantity of holes in, more than usual. So, anyhow, as you might say, life went on, and this was a daily occurrence. We lost a couple, as you might say, but anyhow.
What kind of living conditions were you under at Lefsis?
Well, it was an airport, partly built. There was a runway, which was good, but we had, if you like, empty blocks, empty barrack blocks, or reception rooms, or what have you, and beds were put up, and so on, and portable, everything portable, and we lived there like that. Now, the food, well, we were there 3 days. The first 3 days that we were there, there was no food. And the Greeks, bless their hearts, they supplied us with what was necessary. And eventually the food arrived. But as much as we liked Greek ale, etc., after a while we were pining for a cuppa. Because there's nothing like a cup of tea under stress conditions. Anyhow, that's another thing. But we were doing these raids pretty regularly, and it seemed a little odd. So the Greek intelligence that I spoke of before, they decided to visit a little ruined temple just along the way, a little bit along the Gulf of Corinth. And there was an unfriendly gentleman in there with a radio. And that's why they knew when we were going to arrive over their aerodromes over there, because he radioed our takeoff. We didn't like that very much, but the said gentleman just disappeared. No comment. Anyhow, things picked up from then on, and they didn't know we were coming until we got there. And hectic as it was accepted. That was the way of life. And it didn't bother us then. I mean, we were all tuned to the same thing. Everybody knew their job, and two or three jobs as well. I used to do the wireless, of course, the gunnery, the armament, photography, and help in the cockpit occasionally and so on. Well,
was this a fifth columnist or was he a spy?
That's a question we never got the answer to, but whether he was a Greek or not, I don't really know. He was probably just a spy. Anyhow, the situation was a little bit odd, because in Athens, there were a number of tourists, strange, and it was considered, well, it was proven later, that in each suitcase, there was a German uniform. The German legation was open all the time we were there, because Greece was not at war with Germany. and they did not wish to antagonize Germany, because if they threw their might of force and force against us, we would suffer. So we pressed on. Now, our CO happened to go past the German legation. He was infuriated to see the swastika flag hanging there and the brass plate outside. So he happened to say, I would say probably in anger, I give a fortnight's leave to any man who could put those two on my desk. And they were there the following morning. Now, this created a political situation. It's hilarious in its way, but it really did. And I'm afraid our chief of the legation there, he probably had to apologise. I don't know. One does not delve into such things. But this did actually happen.
Were you involved in this prank?
Oh, no, not me. Not me, sir. No, sir. No, I was not involved with it. I heard about it later. But anyhow, immediately after this, two men were posted back to Egypt. And before they went to their duties, they each had a fortnight's leave. Nuff said. Anyhow, as we sat down, if we were in town and sat down at a table at a bar, and we were chatting around, you see, discussing things of the day, if you wish. Presently, a table near us will be occupied by four other people. Now, three of them will be talking animatedly, absolutely loading the situation with conversation. The fourth one was a listener. He was the one nearest to our table. He would be listening to what the boys were saying. Well, we very soon rumbled this. And so after that, we were told, of course, after that, we used to make outrageous claims about what had happened. You see, hoping that the listener would take the information back to headquarters, or his headquarters. But it became a game. And we thought it was hilarious. We did enjoy it. But that was something else. Anyhow, there was a nightclub there that we found rather soon called the Kit Kat. And as you went up University Street, the last turning on the left at the top, went somewhere, we didn't know where, but just up there on the right was a doorway down into the Kit Kat nightclub. Well, when you went in there, you were greeted by an Englishman, Johnny London. And he said, the drinks are on the house, and took us round to the bar, and the man behind the bar, he explained, he was a Cretan, and he was huge. He was frighteningly huge. Anyhow, I had a drink, whatever, and went and sat down. And whenever we went in, Johnny London always used to come over to see us, because being the first people of the Allies, we were well known. I mean, Johnny knew us all by name, etc. Whereas later on, when other squadrons and the army came over, he didn't know everybody personally. And he told us, if you want anything, don't go and get it. Ask me, and I'll get it for you. No matter what it is. So I said, okay, Johnny, you see. Well, life went on in this battle situation, and Italy became a loser, because the Greeks were pushing them back on each front. And the Greeks, they're very patriotic, and once you get them annoyed about their patriotism, they do something about it. And they really do something about it. Now, there's a little valley way up in the mountains called Paramythea. And this was reached by the Italians at midday, I think it was. At 4:30, they were running for their lives, because the men in the hills, and the women, and the children, with old funny rifles and shotguns and pitchforks and stones and sticks, they drove them out. Now, a Greek, when he's angry, when his country is being threatened, is something you've got to really be careful about, because he's a wonderful man. He's a wonderful man. And so are the women and children. They must not be left out of it, because they all joined in. Anyhow, we were sent up there to operate out of Paramythea when Hitler came into the war. So, I mean, it was a frontline situation. We didn't send, didn't have to use a lot of petrol. We could get to the targets quickly. So, in fact, everything was in our favour. So, we operated out of Paramathia, going to various targets way up into Albania, and in all weathers. Now, when we were doing frontline defence, that was assisting the army by going over to targets that they indicated, which were holding them up, etc. It didn't take us long to get to the target area. And there was one occasion when we did, well, four raids of a morning before lunch was not unusual. And there's a lot of bombs to drop. And not only bombs, but we change the warload sometimes to incendiaries or anti-personnel, depending what the target is. And there was one occasion when our Greek friends said, we're in a difficult situation. We're one side of the valley, and the Italians are the other side. But they're in a wood. And every time we try to advance, they just blasted the ground around us. Do you think you can do something about it? So with much glee, we just loaded up a number of high explosives and incendiaries. We went over and bombed the forest and set fire to it. And the enemy came running out like you can very well imagine, to the great delight of the Greeks, who cut them down right, left and centre. It really was a successful operation. Well now, one day, one of our pilots, he had been flying rather a lot, with no rest. Well, most of us were in that condition, but he'd been doing some extra work. So the CO said, you're going to have to stand down for a couple of days. So he said, I'll tell you what, why don't you go up to the front line and have a word with the Greek soldiers up there, and principally the artillery. So Godfrey, his name was, flying officer Godfrey. So he went up there and he was talking to one of these Greek officers, and he said, well, what is your main barrier now on this particular valley? He said, well, I don't know if you can see it, but just over there, and he indicated with a pointed finger, there's a gun emplacement. And at regular intervals, usually 4 o'clock in the afternoon, they shower us with shells. Can you do anything about it? So Godfrey came back and they worked it on the map, etc. And the following day, that said in gun placement was visited. And it never fired a gun again. We sort of spoiled the terrain around them, which was much to the delight of the Greeks. And they sent a letter of thank you to us, which was, we thought that was rather good. Anyhow, the Germans started to infiltrate and the situation became somewhat intense.
The Germans?
Yes, because they had now joined in the army, in the battle, because Italy couldn't cope. The Greeks were driving them back on all fronts. Not only that, but they're invading into their territory. So Hitler, seeing that his mate, friend, or whatever he might like to call him, hardly ally, he just had to support him. Well, one of the reasons that the Axis wanted to get in to that area was because it's all on the way to the oil wells. And this is what Hitler was after. Oil, fuel for the tanks and ships and what have you. So that's why, as Mussolini had not made the progress into Greece and capturing Greece, Hitler felt he had to do something about it. So he came into it and he brought in the full force of the Luftwaffe. And that is considerable. So we were in a position where things became dangerous. Now, the Greek Air Force had some small fighter planes called, oh, I forget now what they were. They were Czechoslovakian and PZLs, that's right, PZLs. And they were something like a Lysander with a high wing and observers rather than a fighter's aircraft. And one evening, most unhappily, both of them approached the aerodrome from opposite directions, with the obvious result they met in the middle. And they became rather damaged. So they were dragged to the side of the valley there. worked on overnight, and the following morning, one of those two was on the dawn patrol, and they ran into enemy territory, aircraft, and it shot one down. Now, for an aircraft that's been tied up with string and wire after that, that we all thought was very good. We congratulated the Greeks for that. We thought that was very good. But after a while, 33 Squadron arrived with the Gladiators, and another squadron of Gladiators and Hurricanes. Now, this was really welcomed because we had never seen a Hurricane. We'd never seen a monoplane, only biplanes, you see. And, of course, when we went over the target areas, such as Valona, when it was fairly dangerous, they would escort us to the target. And then, when we went about to return, they'd just wander off down to the Valona aerodrome and play El's Delight amongst whatever was down there, you see. And that was great. It was great delight by all of our side. Anyhow, we were pressed against to such a degree that we had to leave Valona. Leave Paramathia and go back to base at Elevsus. And things continued to get worse. Well, it's history now. So we'd only got 4 aircraft left, and they were in a poor condition. I think they stopped mending the holes because it was not the time and so on. Anyhow, we were told to evacuate to Crete. So we went to Crete at a place called Malamy. And the
just before you go to Crete, how much did you have to use your gun as an air gunner in Greece?
Oh, every day. Every day. We'd get rid of so many hundred rounds of ammunition, say, probably 5 magazines of 100 each. Because we're always being attacked. There are always fighters to attack us.
What would be their method of attacking?
Well, the normal one, swoop from above, down below, and onto your tail. And, of course, that's where the air gunner was rather important. Not as a person, but his job was important. And that's why being a tail-end Charlie is very dangerous, but necessary and worthwhile. And, we had the first casualty that we had, unfortunately, was John Merrifield. And a bullet came down through the top of the aircraft, severed his gun cable, and went straight into his heart and killed him. And he fell over to one side, and as he lay there, another bullet came through the side of the aircraft, and that went into his heart as well. An unusual thing to happen, perhaps, but that's what happened to poor old John. And the Greeks were most upset about this. And they wanted to get a bust made of him from stone from the Acropolis. But this, unfortunately, could not take place because of the advance of the Germans. And so I'm afraid that poor John was never sort of cut in stone for eternity. But go ahead.
Carry on. No, you go on.
But we lost a few, and a few aircraft. Not nice to see your friends go down beside you and so on, but you just think, well, there but for the grace of God go I. And you pressed on, and eventually, as things became a little too hot, B and C flights were doing convoy protection and Navy protection as well, because when the Navy was out to go on the job to pick up a convoy, say, they needed protection until they got to the convoy, and then they were covered by the other flights who did the convoy control. And the Navy, by now, the dear old Navy, they'd had it bad coming through the Mediterranean, as is known. And I won't say they were trigger-happy, but they're ever so careful. And our aircraft was very much like a Junker 88. And at a quick glance, you could easily mistake it. So, if the gunners on a naval vessel saw a kite coming in looking like ours, despite the fact that you might lower your undercarriage, flash the letter of the hour, and with the oldest lamp, and fire a very cartridge to the colour of the day, they'd still shoot at you, which was a little unfriendly, but understandable. And, I've been fired at myself many a time by the Navy, I must admit. But this is still just part of the war. Well, anyhow, eventually we were evacuated to Crete and operated out there, doing the same thing, the same jobs. We were now all fighters. We were all doing convoy, escort, etc. And we were running short of ammunition and food. A lot of the time we were on half rations, sleeping down on the soil, with a ground sheet underneath us, that's all, to keep the damp out. And I suppose it hardened us, really. But we got used to it, not necessarily liking it, but we got used to it. And, may I go back and mention an incident which occurred earlier? Oh, well, when we're up at Paramythea, in the mountains there, the weather was pretty poor. Well, most people who've been involved know that mountain territory is subject to fairly sudden changes of weather. And we'd been off one morning. We'd done four raids, actually, before lunch. And it started to rain. Heavens hard! It rained so hard. We were sheltering under the main plane of one of the aircraft, waiting to go off on the next raid. And they said, it's no good, there's no raid, because the visibility is impossible over the target area. And you can't get through there. And remember the old motto, never fly into a cloud, because it may have a mountain in it. So that was something that one learned the hard way, so to speak. Anyhow, we had one trip going across the Corinth Canal when the visibility came down very badly. And as is, well, we knew the conditions were bad, as it was arranged previously, the formation of three of us in a flight opened out to wide formation so that we wouldn't bump into one another in the clouds, you see. And it was rain, heavy rain, right down to the water. So we decided to try and climb above it. And the higher we went, we ran into ice. We got up to 20,000 feet, and we started to ice up. And this, of course, as everybody knows, is highly dangerous. So we decided, well, that's it. We had no sign of the other two aircraft, so the skipper said, better go back. So we did that. We went back, and we waited. And the other aircraft, second aircraft, came in, but not the third aircraft. So one waited and waited until we knew he'd gone past his petrol stand. So, I mean, an aircraft can only fly as long as it's got fuel. And obviously, he must have consumed his fuel, so he was down. Well, we waited and no sign. So we thought, well, he's just found that cloud with the mountain in it. And left it at that, you see. 2 days later, a telephone call came through to the squadron from Twiggy Branch, who was the observer in that said aircraft, to say, we're quite safe, don't worry, and we'll be back in a while. What do you mean, in a while? Well, we don't know, it depends upon transport. Well, they did get back, and the story they told was a little bit hair-raising. Apparently they got up to 22,000 feet and they could just see above them the light of clear weather. But they couldn't reach it because their carburetors iced up and the aircraft went out of control. Now, at 10 past 2, they're at 22,000 feet. At 20 past 2, they're on the ground. Well, the mountains in that area were supposedly about 15,000 feet. So, once the clock had gone past 15, you knew you were in very serious danger. And due to the engines failing, the aircraft flew like a stone and dropped, blew all the windows out of the cockpit, and the skipper said to Twiggy, the observer, bail out. And he couldn't get out because of the air pressure forcing him against the edge of the escape hatch. So he got back in again, and all of a sudden, they came out into clear weather. And there was a little valley, and in the middle of it was a lake. In the middle of the lake was a little man fishing. Well, they knew they were going too fast to try and do a proper wheels down landing, so they landed on the beach, wheels up, and everybody was out of the aircraft before it stopped sliding, because they thought if it catches fire and we're in it, we'll have it. But apparently they all got out safely, and they were standing there watching it burn by 20 past, so that 10 minutes was a little bit hectic. Anyhow, apparently, through the surrounding area, people started to appear with old shotguns and pitchforks and so on, and one of the lads said, "They think we're Italians." So they quickly stripped off their flying suits to reveal their uniform. Of course, when the Greeks saw that they were English, Inglesi, oh well, they just could not do enough for them. They wanted to give them wine, and the boys were wise enough to know if they had too much, they'd be drunk. And they were exhausted, and they toasted them and toasted them, and eventually they said, "Look, we've got to go to bed." So, because, I mean, obviously they didn't speak Greek, and the Greeks didn't speak English, but obviously it was all sign language. Anyhow, they all three got to bed and got some rest. And the following morning was a beautiful morning, and they made such a fuss of them. They couldn't do enough for them. So they said, "Well, we have to get back to the squadron." They indicated, it must have been very difficult for them to indicate odd sentences, but anyhow, they said, "You can't get out of the valley." "Well, how do you mean you can't get out?" "Well, no lorries or anything come this way." "Well, how do you get out?" "Said, oh, we walk." For the first half day, up goat tracks and so on, and then we pick up mules. And mules take us for the second half of the day, and that's a whole day gone getting out of the valley. And eventually they got up to a road, and they found a village, but they didn't have a telephone. So they got a lorry from nowhere, and they went on and found another village which did have a telephone. And that was the telephone call that they received at the squadron to say they were all right. Well, they turned up eventually, totally scruffy, but very happy. I think they each somehow had a small bottle of wine secreted about their person, but that's another story. But that was a happy incident which came out of what appeared to be something pretty grim. Anyhow, to revert back to Crete.
But in Greece, were you satisfied with the gun that you had in the aircraft?
Oh, yes. Well, to start with, we had a Lewis gun, which, as you know, was 1418 standard, like they had in France. And it was a good gun. It was a good gun. Personally, I never had any trouble with them. But they did only about 700 rounds to the minute. And so it was decided to give us a more modern gun, which is the Vickers K gun. And that did about 900 rounds to the minute. And it was a very good gun. It had fewer moving parts, therefore less chance of a jam. Anyhow, we finished up all the time then with Vickers K guns. And we went on from there. Oh, a small incident, incidentally. When we were up at Paramathea there, we were on, well, I say half rations, not much, not at all hardly. Everything was very short. And as I say, we were standing under the main plane after a terrible rainstorm. "Back to the tent," they said. "That's all you can do. Try and catch up on your sleep." So we went back to the tent when we found it, because it had been moved, because the ground was so soggy that the tent pegs were pulling out. Anyhow, they moved us to a place where they thought it was the ground was a little firmer. But unfortunately, they erected the tent right over the tracks of the lorry that had brought it, in consequence of which we had two little streams running through the tent, which is not conducive to going to sleep. You had to find a place where you could lay down. Well, anyhow, we unrolled our bedrolls, and I don't know why, even to this day, but I had a funny feeling. I stood on my bed after I'd taken my flying boots off, and as I took off my uniform, I stacked it on top of the boots. And we got into our kips and lay there. And then presently, we heard the roar of a storm approaching, more so than it had been before.